This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
The time has come for many things, for peace, for climate action, for economic sanity. The list is long. This week on Radio EcoShock, we thunder into another place humans don't like to go. The nasty truth is we're killing off the only known living companions we have in this universe, as our first guest says. The venerable biologist and head of the Stanford Center for Biodiversity, Paul Ehrlich, joins us. He's followed by Will Tuttle, author of The World Peace Diet. Will says you can't care about climate change and still eat meat, because about half of all global emissions are driven by the industrial slaughter of our fellow species. Too much information? Don't worry, be happy with this week's Climate Variety Hour.
In just 10 minutes.
Get inspired with Bernie Sanders, climate humor from UK's Guardian newspaper, and bits from climate songs by people who can actually sing. I'm Alex Smith. Welcome to Radio EcoShock. Among stories of Middle East refugees and stock market jitters, we find brief notices that species are disappearing rapidly all over the world. In a scientific journal and a new book, famed scientists Paul and Ann Ehrlich warn that humans are driving the sixth great mass extinction here on Earth. Just released in September, their new book is titled The Annihilation of Nature, Human Extinction of Birds and Mammals. As an author and co-author of more than 40 books, Paul R. Ehrlich is the Bing Professor of Population Studies and the president of the Center for Conservation Biology at Stanford University, and we reached him there. Paul, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Nice to be back.
Your book title uses the word annihilation. Is that just for sensationalism, or do you mean it?
Well, we mean it because basically we're losing the biodiversity of the planet, the only known living companions we have in the entire universe, and they're all critically important to us. Not every species, but virtually every population plays a role in the system that supports our lives. So, yeah, scientists are very scared about this. They're particularly scared because people don't really understand much about the threat. And that's too bad, but it's a big threat, just as big and involved with such things as climate change.
And you write about the current times as the sixth great extinction. Can you tell us when the previous great dying of species happened and how serious was it?
Well, there are five previous ones. I can't enumerate every one right off the top of my head, but the one that virtually everybody has heard of occurred about 66 million years ago when an extraterrestrial object hit the Earth and wiped out, among other things, all the dinosaurs except for the birds, caused a horrendous decline in the diversity of life. Now, one of the things we have to remember is that was more than 65 million years before anything like a human being appeared on the planet. So what we're facing now is a catastrophic event, along with a civilization of more than 7 billion people trying to survive. So we're in a much different situation. The dinosaurs disappeared. Hopefully we won't.
How do we know, though, Paul, that these extinctions are being driven by humans rather than being part of some natural cycle so often found in Earth's long history?
Well, again, we have had five natural events, but the way we know that human beings are doing it now is simply a large set of observations plus correlations. We've looked at very conservative estimates of how many species we've lost over the last few hundred years, and we've looked at very conservative estimates of the rates of extinction that occurred between the mass extinction events. In other words, evolution is always going on. New species are always being formed, and they're many times going extinct. And there has been over all of our history a steady production of species and a steady loss of species as various things drove them extinct. But there are these five outstanding events when all of a sudden the rate of extinction went way, way, way up. And so what has been tested scientifically is, where is the rate of extinction today compared with the rate of extinction in the past that was standard, that was not in one of the great extinction episodes, that was a background rate, the one that was always going on. And looking conservatively at both ends of the story, it turns out that the extinction rate today is already somewhere between 10 and 100 or more times the background rate, which shows we're starting into a vast new extinction, and it's clearly being caused by human beings. I mean, virtually anybody who's looked at what's going on in nature can see that extinction is an ongoing process because many species on the planet, maybe most of them, are losing populations all the time. And losing populations is how you become extinct. In other words, when the last population is gone, the species is extinct.
So how does this book relate to the scientific study on extinction you and Anne and Geraldo Ceballos published in June of this year in the journal Science Advances?
Well, the book and the paper are related to each other very closely. The book gives a lot more explanation for lay people of what the values we're losing are and where the losses are. We're trying to bring to people more of an emotional feel of what we're losing because most people now are isolated in cities, don't know much about what goes on in the natural world, don't know where their food comes from. For example, one of the extinction problems that's very, very serious is the loss of pollinators that are necessary for our crops. If a person thinks that their food comes from the supermarket, they don't get what the real picture is. And for example, if we lost just the honeybees from North America, and they are in trouble, the cost to us in nutrition would be about $18 billion and a considerable loss in the nutritional value of our diets. And yet, if the honeybees just disappeared from North America, there would be no species extinction, just an extinction of populations. So you got to look at the world as that supports us as running by the populations of millions of species, and we're losing the populations rapidly, and losing the populations leads eventually to the loss of the species. By the time a species is endangered, the value of the populations to human beings is way down. For example, if we had killed off all the honeybees except one population in Central Africa where they originated, we still wouldn't have lost the species, but we would have lost all the pollination services worth many billions of dollars. So you can't just look at it as loss of species. You got to look at it as loss of biodiversity.
Now, in a review of your new book in the Los Angeles Times, Fred Pierce says there have been only 800 extinctions registered in the last 400 years. He thinks you're being too emotional about all this, Paul. What do you say?
Well, first of all, I am emotional about it. Second of all, poor Fred Pierce is a very confused man and has been for a long time. He, for example, says that the only problem is not population size, it's just per capita consumption. He doesn't seem to understand the two multiply together, and saying something like that is like saying the area of a rectangle is the fault of the width, not the length. We say in the book that you don't have to know we're losing biodiversity because we're losing habitat any more than we have to know what every grain of sand on the beach is in order to know a beach is eroding away. And he says, no, you got to count the grains of sand. In other words, he does not understand the environment. He does not understand science. But for some reason, he gets to publish nonsense. And, you know, there's nothing you can do about that.
Well, we know there are climate deniers. Do you think there are also developing extinction deniers?
There are people who don't want to face that we're facing an existential challenge in climate, in loss of biodiversity, in what we're doing with toxics, in the plastic microparticles problem that's developing and so on. And the scientific community has been very forthcoming on this. And yet you may have noticed there have been a couple of debates in which no serious problem has been discussed. Haven't talked at all about the population problem, about the climate problem, about the toxics problem, about the extinction problem, and so on. And yet these are what concern the people who are really interested in seeing that our civilization persists.
I thought birds would be the great survivors. They can move away from threats towards better living zones, but your team writes that they are in trouble. Why is that?
Well, they can move, but unfortunately, we're destroying the places they can move to very often. We're also putting up barriers that prevent them from moving as far and as fast as they'd like to. In other words, there are all kinds of problems with the refueling stations for the tropical birds that spend the summer in North America and then return to the tropics. So Some birds are very, very resilient. Others aren't. That's a general story with animals. That is, some are more easily threatened by things like climate change than others. And all these problems are tied tightly together because, of course, extinction of populations of trees is now increasing our chances of more climate change. So this is a huge nexus of problems that everybody should be educated about, but which, unfortunately, most of our politicians are not. And that's one of the things we're hoping to do in the annihilation of nature is bring it home in a more personal way to see what the birds and mammals are that are under threat, why they're under threat, and what that means to us, and what we might be able to do to change it.
And animals most like us, carnivore hunters, are becoming extinct first and foremost. Could you tell us, Paul, about a couple of the great creatures in jeopardy and their chances for survival?
Well, one good example, an iconic animal, is the lion, whose populations are declining rapidly. They used to extend all the way to India from Africa, but now they're refined, except for a very few in one part of India. They're confined to Africa, and they're suffering from distemper, from domestic dog contacts. They're being hunted still in places, and unfortunately, their bones are now being featured in Chinese medicine. Same thing with the black rhinoceros, which is now so endangered in South Africa that they're shipping their black rhinos to Botswana, which is in Africa the best country in terms of how they deal with conservation, because poaching is so critical on the black rhinos because their horns are thought to be aphrodisiacs in Chinese medicine. And they're also supposed to be aphrodisiacs when you make them into daggers for the Middle East. And one of the saddest things I've heard recently is we thought Viagra might save the rhino because Viagra actually works. But it turns out now the dealers are grinding Viagra into the rhino horn so that the rhino horn really works. So those are a couple of famous cases of things that are in deep trouble, but there are many, many others.
Wow, that's pitiful. You know, here in Canada, Paul, we just had a hockey player charged for taking macho pictures of himself with a grizzly bear he illegally slaughtered. And then there's the dentist who shot Cecil the lion. Is this partly just a testosterone problem, as you've been speaking about?
Well, I think you can imagine my opinion of the dentist. And, you know, if you want to actually be a sportsman, then go hunt a lion with a .22 rifle, maybe, and not with somebody guarding you. But it's unfortunate, I have to say, or I shouldn't say it's unfortunate. The hunting is a minor factor compared to destruction of habitat and the things I was talking about in Africa, the poaching on the rhinos, and particularly rhinos and elephants are in trouble because of the market in rhino horn and in ivory. There's an animal called the scaly anteater. There's another name for him which skips my mind now, but there's 13 species that are being killed all over the world because the scales play a role in Chinese medicine. So there's a huge trade in wildlife, but hunting per se is mostly serious when poor people hunt for bushmeat. And, of course, that's another problem that we have to face, that there are a lot of people in the world who don't have enough to eat. And if you don't have enough to eat, it's the ground pangolin. The pangolin is this name I was coming up with. But pangolins are hunted to be eaten. They're a delicacy in parts of China. But, again, there are a lot of poor people who get their food directly from nature. It's called bushmeat. And who can blame them? We got to find ways to control that trade and make sure everybody has a decent diet, which we don't do at the moment.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock, and I'm Alex Smith talking with the famous ecologist Paul R. Ehrlich about our destruction of Earth's other creatures. Well, you mentioned habitat loss, Paul. In a developed world, we may not slaughter species directly, but we steal their habitat for resources, new shopping malls, and suburbs. Why isn't there a plan to save the species, or is there one?
Well, some countries pay more attention than we do. Botswana is way ahead of the United States in conservation. Mexico is way ahead of the United States in conservation. But in the United States, a strip mall is always valued more than habitat for organisms that we either appreciate or that are part of our life support system. And that's sad. And again, it's not debated. In other words, most people don't know there's a real conservation problem, don't know that we're entering the great extinction crisis that could end our civilization. And that's sad. That's why I'm raving at you on the radio.
Did you go into how climate change will speed up this extinction event in your book?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Several things are missing from the media. For example, have you heard anybody point out that the more people there are, the greater the climate change is going to be, because each person contributes greenhouse gases to the atmosphere? The climate population connection has not been made. The population extinction connection has not been made. And the connection between climate change and extinction, because, of course, climate change changes habitats very rapidly. I mean, we're for instance, right now on the West Coast in California, I think in British Columbia as well, the forests are being changed dramatically by drought and new fire regimes, and that means the inhabitants of those forests are going to have great trouble and are going to be more threatened with extinction.
Do you think it's possible that DNA from disappearing species could be saved to bring them back later in a more ecologically sane world? Is such a project in the works?
Well, there are some people trying to do that, but it's actually a total waste of time. The basic thing is it's so much easier to save the habitat while it still exists and save the organisms while they still exist. The so-called de-extinction movement is basically made work for idiots. And it's one of the saddest things because, I like Jurassic Park. Great movie. But scientifically nonsense, and that is something that's being it has a huge threat, because it makes people who are ignorant of science believe they don't have to worry, because all we have to do is put the several billion populations we have on the planet now that are genetically different in freezers and everything will be fine.
Well, we've just received a new study saying that half the fish in the sea have disappeared since you and I were born. It's just another brief headline, though, Paul, competing with Hollywood news and the stock market. How can giant and dangerous trends like the ones we're talking about get past that everyday roar of sensational media?
Well, I think you would say probably for you and for me, if we knew how, we'd sure as hell do it. We keep trying. But I was once told by Ben Bradley that I had suggested to him that the Washington Post every day put in numbers about how much CO2 there is in the atmosphere, how big the human population was, how many people were starving, and so on. And he told me, no. He says, we don't want to have numbers in the newspaper. Nobody likes numbers. And I said, have you ever looked at the sports or the financial pages? And he said, well, he kind of backed off on that. But then he told me that he wanted his science reporters to be utterly ignorant of science so they could be unbiased. And I said, do you hire sports reporters who don't know what a strike and a ball is? The media has serious, serious problems, as I think you know.
Yep. Well, in your book, there's a lot of gorgeous photographs. How were they selected and why are they there?
Well, the whole idea is to make people know what we're losing. Most people don't pay attention. And so we selected what we thought were a lot of attractive and interesting animals. We took some of our own favorite pictures. There's one in there of one of the most spectacular sights I've ever seen that I wish every human being had a chance to see, with something like 3,000 wildebeest, a herd of about 3,000 wildebeest storming into the Mara River and crossing as fast as possible so they can avoid being eaten by crocodiles. And that's the kind of scene that, you know, we had an abundance on the planet during the Pleistocene, is very rare today, ought to be preserved, and we ought to find ways to get as many people to see it as possible. But short of seeing it, a movie or a picture is the best we can do.
So you're the head of a Center for Conservation Biology at Stanford. What are the steps needed to save what species are remaining, and what agencies need to take leadership in this?
Well, the most basic steps, of course, as we've published many times, is to reduce the scale of the human enterprise. There are many too many people, and they are consuming much too much, many of them, and too many of them don't have enough to eat, so they don't consume enough. And so unless we have to tackle the population and consumption problem, and the notion that we can grow forever. The you know, we have this faith-based economic system which says on a finite planet we can continue to grow forever and not worry about anything. And those are the fundamental things that need to be changed. A lot of scientists are trying to change them. A very famous climate scientist is going to jail trying to get people to close down coal-fired plants, which we should be doing immediately. Those are the main things to do while we do the standard conservation things in hopes of saving some of the parts, because it's going to take a long time to humanely reduce the size of the human population, to convince people they don't have to have 50 new iPhones every day, and so on and so forth. So we got a lot to do, and unhappily there are not many people doing it.
Now, Paul Ehrlich, you don't have a reputation for looking on the bright side of things. Is there any hope for the threatened animal life, or do we just shrug it off and hope it never gets to us?
I got a standard answer for that. I used to say that I am very pessimistic about where we're going, but I'm very optimistic about where we could go. I now would say I'm still optimistic about where we could go if we choose to do so, but my pessimism has increased by such things as having political debates in which the critical existential issues are not even discussed. So, yeah, there's a lot we could do. Boy, we could start right now, and it would cheer me up and cheer up my colleagues very much. But we're not doing it. In other words, we're still not making the big changes in the use of fossil fuels we should. We still have people who think that it's okay to have 5 children. Matter of fact, it may not even be okay to have 2 anymore. When we hear population discussed in the U.S. like it is, say, in Australia, I'll become more cheery, but I'm not looking forward to it.
And do we hide this fear of annihilation from school children? What do we tell the kids?
Well, what we have to tell the kids is it's going to be in their laps. These changes, we're leaving them a world that is in tough shape, and part of their job is going to be to have to help dig us out of it. You know, I love talking to the people in middle school and so on, where they haven't yet formed their views but can understand everything. And children can be a big force for conservation. You know, when the Exxon Valdez oil spill occurred, the kids of the Exxon executives in Alaska gave them hell. They came home and said, "Daddy, why is your company doing this? We need more of that."
So as we wrap up, is there anything I've missed, Paul, that you'd like to leave with our listeners?
Well, I'd like to leave with the listeners that they shouldn't take my word on it. That they should look in the literature, see what the scientific community says, learn about these problems, and then do something about it. I think every functional human being who is rich enough not to have to just worry about where his or her food is coming from should be putting something like 10% of their time into one of the many places in which people can act. If you want to do something, go to mahb.stanford.edu, mahb.stanford.edu. Become a mobster and help save the world.
We've been talking about disappearing nature with the renowned ecologist Paul R. Ehrlich, with the Mexican ecologist Geraldo Ceballos. Paul and Ann Ehrlich have just released their new book, The Annihilation of Nature, Human Extinction of Birds and Mammals. You can find links to the book and the science behind this conversation in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Paul Ehrlich, thank you so much for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
My pleasure as always. Thank you.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. It's not too hard to get sympathy for the awful killing of iconic animals in the wild. Everybody loves the elephants, lions, and tigers. It's a lot harder to get anyone to listen to the awful truth about our treatment of the animals, those animals who tolerate humans the most, the gentle cows, intelligent pigs, and docile chickens. In the United States alone, 75 million animals are killed every day for the meat diet that is scientifically documented to make people sick and fat. 2 out of every 3 Americans are overweight or obese. It's an epidemic that is spreading throughout the world. Many of our listeners know climate change is real and not a good thing, yet we try not to know that at least half of all greenhouse gas emissions come not from cars or factories, but from the far-flung empire of animal agriculture. If you don't believe it, get ready for the man who blows up the lies behind what we eat.
Radio EcoShock.
What is at the root of our violence towards nature, our indifference to changing the climate, and our murderous relationship with all the other species? Will Tuttle says he knows. Actually, that's Dr. Will Tuttle. His PhD comes from the University of California in Berkeley. Tuttle is a blazing speaker at conferences organized by vegetarians, animal rights activists, and progressive spiritualists. He also helped organize events like the online Vegan Palooza in 2012. A listener suggested Will Tuttle for Radio EcoShock, and I admit I had my doubts. Until I listened to a couple of his YouTube presentations, he is on to something big that you should hear. Will Tuttle, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you, Alex, so much for having me, and thank you, everyone, for listening.
Well, I've been working on animal rights off and on this program, although it's not our major feature. Mostly we talk about climate change, and I'm always looking for the big picture, though, people that can clarify the right direction for action. And I know you've got that, but let's build up to it a bit. Let's start with, what set a younger Will Tuttle on your path of compassion for the animals?
Well, briefly, you know, I was raised in a typical family here in the States back in the 1950s in Concord, Massachusetts, eating the usual meals, lots of meat, dairy products, and eggs, and never questioning it. When I was maybe 7 years old, I said to my mother, so the food we're eating, is this what everybody eats? And my mother said, yep, this is what everybody eats. And then she came back a few minutes later, and she said, well, actually, there are vegetarians, and I had never heard that word in my life, but she said, don't worry, you'll never meet one. And she said, I've never met one, and I don't know where they get their protein. So I basically learned at that point that vegetarians are hypothetical people. And my mother was totally right. I went through life. I used to go away in the summers up to Vermont to the summer camp where it was affiliated with a small organic dairy, and we would slaughter our own chickens and slaughter the cows ourselves. And so I participated in all of that, and I think I did it, of course, because I was a product of my community and my family and my society, and I knew that this is what you were supposed to do. But to make a long story short, after college, in my early 20s, I ended up going on a kind of like a spiritual pilgrimage. I just didn't want to go right into working, and so I wandered a little bit around the United States. This was in the mid-1970s, and I ended up at the time the largest hippie commune in the world. Actually, it was called The Farm. It was about 900 people living there in Tennessee. Most of them were from California, actually, and they were all vegetarians. And actually, I think today we would probably call them vegans because they didn't eat dairy products or eggs either. And they were not dying of a protein deficiency. They probably had about 200 kids that were thriving, and they were all vegan from birth, basically. So I realized that it's not necessary to eat animal foods because of this living example that I was living there with these people. And when I found out, when I asked them why, and they told me that basically because we feed most of the grain and food that we're growing, we feed the animals and eat their flesh and secretions while people are starving. And when I learned that, and also they talked a little bit about the abuse of the animals that they endure by the millions every day. And so I think at the same time, you know, being able to eat meals with them, that was it. I never had eaten meat again in my life since that day back in 1975, 40 years ago. And then about 5 years later, I learned about the cruelty to cows and hens. And so I became a vegan in 1980. And a few years later, I was able to go to a Zen monastery in Korea. I lived as a Zen monk, actually, in Korea and did a lot of meditation back in the 80s. And found myself actually for the second time in my life in a community that was vegan. but they didn't call it vegan either. But there was no meat or dairy or eggs or wool or silk or leather or anything. And it was essentially a practice they'd been engaging in for probably 700 or 800 years, primarily for, I would say, spiritual and ethical reasons, not to cause suffering to others. So that was it for me. I think really the main reason I was eating meat was because of the communities I was raised in. And the main way I was able to get out of it, actually, was these communities, these two communities that I experienced living in. And since then, I've discovered that eating animal foods is devastating to our environment, as well as to our society, and I would say also to our health and our and the inner landscape of our consciousness.
Well, now, Will, we've just talked with the famous biologist Dr. Paul Ehrlich. He and his wife Anne have a new book saying we are annihilating wild mammals and birds. Is that along with your thinking?
No question about it. It's we're in the middle of the largest mass extinction of other species in 65 million years, driven essentially by one thing, people taking out their wallets and paying for meat, dairy products, and eggs. That's the driving force, because what's driving the force of the mass extinction of species is loss of habitat, destruction of habitat, destruction of rainforest, destruction of oceans. And what's driving that, we're cutting down about an acre per second right now of rainforest, and that's not all there's one reason for it. We're growing soy, basically growing soy to feed the factory farm pigs and cows and chickens, and also people don't realize it, but factory farm fish eat huge amounts of soy too, which are, the fish are then usually fed to other fish or fed to cows and pigs and chickens. But anyway, we're cutting down rainforests. We're overfishing the oceans. I just read the other day we've lost over half of the animals in the oceans in the last 50 years are gone. So that's all from meat and dairy and fish eating. That's it. That's the driving force.
Well, I suppose we're ready for the heavier stuff, except most of us are never really ready to talk or even to hear about our treatment of agricultural animals. How does that taboo reach even into people who otherwise consider themselves progressive and caring humans?
Well, I think, you know, Alex, the thing is very similar probably to living in say, South Carolina back in the 1820s, you know, where you'd go to church every Sunday and the minister would preach in glowing terms about what a wonderful world we live in, where everything is in order and the white people are superior and black people are inferior and they're here to serve us and to be our slaves. And this is the way it is. You know, this is the wonderful world we live in. And we may be progressive, you know, in a certain way, but we are all essentially injected with a narrative from the time we're little kids. And the most powerful way we're injected with the official stories of our society are through the mealtime rituals. We sit down for breakfast, lunch, and dinner from the time we're little infants, and we eat the flesh and secretions of horribly abused and tortured animals. We don't just watch the adults eating it. You know, we have to eat it ourselves, too. We're forced into it. And so that basically shuts down, I think, in many ways, our critical ability in this situation. We're just not able to look at it, and we have these overtones of feelings of security and respect for our parents and all these things. So it just causes a lot of cognitive dissonance and affective dissonance. We just get very uncomfortable thinking about the horrible abuse that we're causing when we take out our wallets and pay for meat, dairy products, and eggs to people who are starving, to the animals who are suffering so terribly, to wildlife, which is being completely destroyed by ranching and animal agriculture, to slaughterhouse workers that have to stab animals every day and who do work that brings out the worst in them, who have the highest rates of worker-related injuries, as well as drug addiction, alcohol abuse, spousal abuse, and so forth. And so the violence in animal agriculture is far greater than anything else we're doing. But we're genteel people, we're progressive people. It's very easy for us to just cover it over and not talk about it, because that's what 97% of the people are doing, basically. So it's time, I think, just to, you know, understand that and realize that if we want to have an earth that we're going to leave to our children, then we have to begin to become more conscious and mindful of the consequences of our actions.
You know, Will, when I was 13, I found a book on my granddaddy's shelf, and it was a horrifying collection of photos from the Holocaust, and nobody told me that there was industrialized murder of humans. And hearing you talk about what happens on big business farms, as they call them, especially the concentrated food lot operations, it reminds me of the Holocaust. Is there a comparison there to be made?
Yeah, I think it's very clear. I mean, the original word itself, Holocaust, literally means whole burning. And it was originally meant the whole burning of animals for food and the killing and stabbing of animals. That's what the Holocaust literally is. I mean, that's what it actually is. And then the ways that were developed to dismember animals in an assembly line or disassembly line is probably a better word for it. Fashion was actually the foundation of Henry Ford and his assembly lines and all that, but also really the foundational paradigm that was followed by the Nazis in Germany, too, using the same cattle cars to ship the people in and using similar types of mass killing that had been practiced on animals already. So, you know, psychologists understand very well. I mean, they understand very well that anyone who is a mass murderer of people always practices on animals first. That anyone, that if a child grows up and abuses animals and is allowed to do that, very often they will grow up to do the same thing to other people. And we have a society where we're basically, just in the United States alone, for example, we're killing 75 million animals every single day. This is a huge killing machine that just numbs us. And so how can we expect, if we're willing and able to, each one of us, contribute to this, to killing so many animals, that we would not... that we would fail to stop the killing machine of other human beings, that we have nuclear weapons, that we can kill each other many times over, we have wars continuing, prisons. The whole violent system essentially is founded upon the daily killing and abuse of animals for food.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Dr. Will Tuttle, the author of The World Peace Diet, and we'll be talking about that shortly. What about the animal agriculture and climate change? Are there solid links there?
Yeah, that's another thing that I think is all too often glossed over. There's a new movie called Cowspiracy, which I think really helps to show a little bit of how this works. But basically, you know, animal agriculture uses enormous amounts of petroleum. People don't realize that. Also, enormous amounts of water. We're talking about 1,000 gallons of water to make 1 gallon of milk, for example. And the cows that are used in all animals, actually pigs and chickens as well, they emit enormous quantities of methane as well as nitrous oxide. Methane is about 70 times more powerful as a greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide, and nitrous oxide is about 300 times more powerful. And as well as the fact that we're cutting down the rainforests, which are the lungs of the earth, And also the oceans are being destroyed by the runoff and also the acidification caused by animal agriculture, the nutrient-rich runoff from fertilizer. So altogether, this is driving global climate change more than any other activity. The World Bank, I think as people know, Anhang and Goodland, did in their research, found that animal agriculture is a full 51% of all human activity. I mean, you know, animal agriculture is the leading cause of climate destabilization. And right here where I'm standing right now in Northern California, just, you know, a week ago, there were fires raging all around me. Right here, I saw my own neighbors' houses burning in flames. We lost 1,500 homes right here. And the scientists at UC Berkeley just recently said that it has never been this dry and hot in California in over 500 years. This is unprecedented. And so the actual destruction of, we've had 150,000 acres of forest has burned here just in the last 2 months and killing people and destroying homes. I mean, global climate destabilization by animal agriculture, if we don't wake up to what we're doing, we're not going to have a world for our children, even probably for ourselves.
Wow. So tell us about the World Peace Diet. Is it a printed book? Is it an audio book or what?
Yeah, the World Peace Diet actually came out exactly 10 years ago. This is the 10th year anniversary, and it was a number one Amazon bestseller in 2010. And it's available as an audiobook, as an ebook. It's also been translated now into, I think it's, we're up to about 18 languages worldwide. So we just got back actually from doing some lectures in Austria, Germany, Italy, Switzerland, and so forth. And it's just wonderful to see, I think, that there is a, an awakening to the underlying message, which is that our mistreatment of animals for food is actually a mistreatment of the earth as well as ourselves, and that we can, each one of us can make a positive change. So the book is available. It's out there in many languages, and I go into these ideas much more, I think, much more in depth and probably a lot more, a lot better said, too, than I speak in.
Well, you're doing pretty great, I think. Is it natural for cows to eat meat or fish? And what happens when they do?
Yeah, that's another thing that people don't realize. You know, fortunately, people are starting to talk about it, but cows actually are eating more fish than human beings in the United States, because scientists discovered actually decades ago that it's profitable to enrich the feed of cows with fish meal, along with other things. Roadkill and a whole lot of other stuff is all ground up at the renderers. So this pushes the cows unnaturally, not only to fatten up for beef, but also to give more milk than they normally would. And it's not natural for them. It causes all kinds of problems. It's the driving force really behind E. coli, which is, you know, also causing a lot of trouble for human beings because there's feces that's embedded in the flesh of meat. That's pretty well known. So it's very important, I think, to realize that the way that we're raising these animals, feeding them and breeding them and so forth, is not only unnatural, it's profoundly abusive, that they suffer from the time they're born till the time they die. And if they're killed at very young ages, so it's really a slaughter of infants. And the only ones that live a little bit longer are the dairy cows. They live maybe 4 years, 4 years of misery, and are repeatedly impregnated against their will and have their babies stolen, and their babies are killed. Three out of the four will be killed. Only one will be allowed to be a slave like her mother on the dairy. So on any dairy, organic or not, it's essentially a rape and kill operation, giving us foods that we are not designed. We don't have renin like little calves have, which is the basic enzyme that we would need to break down casein, which is the main protein in milk. So the whole driving force behind autoimmune diseases, most of the childhood problems like runny noses and earaches and sore throats and tonsillitis and appendicitis and all these things are directly linked to dairy. So it's a great boon to the pharmaceutical medical industry to have this thing going, but it's just so much suffering to the female animals and to their babies.
Now, as a vegan, you say it's not natural for humans to eat meat either. I know many listeners will be doubtful about that. Have there been scientific studies that found early humans, say before the agricultural revolution, did not eat meat? I mean, didn't cavemen eat meat and hunt the woolly mammoths into extinction?
Yeah, that's a really good question, too. You know, it's very interesting. Just lately, as people, you know, do more and more research, the story's always changing. And I think it's important to always remember that our understanding of history, even what happened on 9/11, you know, we don't really know. We have official stories. And the same thing is true, I think, when we go back to prehistory, we have official stories. But those have been changing a lot in the last few years as we have realized, actually, a few important things. One is that the early humans going back 400,000 years ago, going way back, have amylase, which is essentially the enzyme that is only does one thing in our saliva, and that is break down complex carbohydrates that are found in starches. So now the whole official story of anthropologists is undergoing a radical change, that human beings did not eat much meat. They ate very, very little meat. Maybe 4% of their diet was meat. 96% of their diet was fruits and starches, starchy tubers, and things that they could gather. And this was reliable food, and we can tell that from the DNA, from the saliva, amylase, DNA, genetic composition. So the whole idea that we are naturally supposed to be eating meat, you can tell from our physiology. I mean, we have a physiology that's not designed for meat. I mean, I go into this in depth in the World Peace Diet, but essentially we can eat meat, like cows. Cows can eat meat, you know, but it's not good for them, but they can fatten up and get sick, you know, eating meat, but you know, it's the same thing with us. We can do it, but our body would much rather have starch and vegetables and fruits and grains and nuts. These are the things we're designed to eat.
And what about the people who say they crave meat? I mean, people love the smell of bacon. You can have bacon peanut butter, probably bacon toothpaste for all I know. But doesn't that suggest that human meat eating is natural?
Well, you know, people crave a lot of things. I mean, if you had kids forced into smoking cigarettes from the time they were infants, they would probably crave smoking tobacco. They would say it smells so good. You know, they would just really want to do it. This doesn't mean it's natural. It doesn't mean it's healthy. If you just go to any grocery store and look at the baby food section, you will see these little jars of beef and turkey and chicken and veal and cheese. I mean, that's what we're given from the time we're little kids. That's why we like it. It's because we're forced into it. You know, for me, after 40 years, if I smell meat, it's disgusting. I mean, there's something hideous about it. You know, if you were to tell someone, well, could you give up eating bacon? They say, no, I could never give that up. It's so delicious. And then you say, well, could you give up eating dog? And they say, what are you talking about? That's disgusting. And yeah, I remember when I was a Zen monk in Korea, and I asked a guy if he could give up eating dog. He said, no way. I love dog. Could you give up eating beef? Oh, I would never eat that. That's disgusting. Now, it's just cultural programming. That's all.
So are there vegan cultures in the world, and are they healthy?
My feeling is that it has happened before. I talk about it in the World Peace Diet. There was a great revolution that happened on this planet, the herding revolution, when we started owning animals as property for food. And that culture brought in slavery. It brought in war. It brought in the domination of women and patriarchy. And it's based on dominating animals for food. And that is the culture we're born in. And that culture has taken over the whole planet for the last basically 10,000 years. So I think it's hard to see other cultures now. But I think it is possible, if we look back historically, to find remnants of sane, compassionate, and environmentally sustainable cultures. And I think the future for us as human beings is definitely to move in that direction.
So could we make this big change? I mean, what would the world look like with a vegan human population?
Oh, my gosh, that's an incredibly good question. I think it's just, you know, if you just want to have a beautiful moment, just sit back and imagine a vegan world. Because imagining a vegan world is imagining a completely different society, utterly different. We can't even probably comprehend it. A world based on kindness and respect for creation, for the whole beautiful and abundant earth, for ecosystems, for animals, for each other, a world based on sustainability. We can feed everyone on this planet on a tiny fraction of the land. My wife, Madeline, and I lived for 17 years in an RV. We saw that most of the land has been enslaved to monocrop corn and soy to feed to these cows and pigs and chickens that are stuck away in these stinking sheds where they never see the light of day. So a vegan world would be none of that. The prisons would be free. The animal prisons would be free. The war would be destroyed. We'd be healthy and radiant. We could feed everyone on local agriculture. We could have local economies where we support each other. We could grow food that really heals us. You know, we have a garden. We have a food forest here now, and we've only been here a few years, but we've built a food forest. We saw people in Canada that were doing that. And when you just make a connection to the earth, you grow your own food, you're feeding life with life. The food will heal us and support us. We can feed everyone, as I say, on a fraction of the land. The streams could come back. The rivers could come back. The oceans could come back. Animals could come back. Instead of being a curse on this planet like we are now, we could find our place. We could live our purpose as blessing the world rather than destroying it.
How do we find like-minded people who can help us make the change away from killing animals for food?
I think the best way to find these like-minded people is to be one ourselves. You know, that's what I've discovered. When I make the change myself authentically, when I question the official stories and move to a plant-based diet for ethical reasons, then I create a field around me of freedom, of peace, of joy, of love, of caring, of kindness, compassion, empathy, sustainability, liberation, and I become a magnet for other people who have a similar interest. And I just start meeting them here and meeting them there, and pretty soon we can create meetups, we can create alternative communities, we create a movement. It's a grassroots movement that's invisible to the mass media pretty much. But it's definitely growing. I've been giving 150 events a year now for many years, all over the United States, North America, the world, actually now, Australia, New Zealand, China, everywhere, Europe. And basically, it's a massive movement that's growing, and it's the most important movement on this planet is the vegan movement, the movement for compassion and kindness and sustainability based not just on theorizing about it, but actually living it in the most crucial way, which is our daily meals. This is where the rubber meets the road. This is where we're actually voting for what the kind of world we want to have, and if we're going to be heartless and murder and kill other living beings, or if we're going to be kind and compassionate and realize that we live in a world that's essentially, potentially benevolent, that we can live with kindness and love and caring on this planet. And then I think instead of being afraid of us, the animals would become our friends.
Listeners, do you want to free the animals and your own mind and conscience along with it? Try the work of Dr. Will Tuttle and the World Peace Diet. It's all at willtuttle.com. Will, thank you so much for joining us on Radio EcoShock.
Oh, thank you so much, Alex.
In that interview, Will Tuttle quotes the figure of 51% of climate change emissions driven by animal agriculture. He cites a study by Robert Goodlin and Jeff Anhang. The title is Livestock and Climate Change. You can Google that, or you can find a link to that study in my show blog at ecoshock.info, which is published every Wednesday. All right, it's time for the Climate Variety Hour.
In just 10 minutes.
For folks trained by the tweetosphere, here are some of the climate sounds that zipped past my ears this week, some of them thanks to tips from Radio EcoShock listeners. Tired of Republican climate deniers and Democratic wafflers? Here's a minute and a half from Democratic presidential candidate Bernie Sanders in a speech to enthusiastic, mostly African-American college students at Benedict College in Columbia, South Carolina. That was September 9th, 2015.
And when we talk about important issues facing our country, we have got to understand that as adults, we have a moral responsibility to make certain that we leave this planet healthy and habitable for our kids and our grandchildren. And I want everybody here to know, because I sit on both the Environmental Committee and the Energy Committee in the U.S. Senate, and I've talked to a lot of scientists over the years. The debate is over within the scientific community. Climate change is real. Climate change is caused by human activity. Climate change today is already causing devastating problems in our country and all over the world. And in my view, if we are concerned about our kids and our grandchildren, we have got to do everything that we can to lead the effort, work with China, Russia, India, and other countries in transforming this planet's energy system away from fossil fuel to energy efficiency and sustainable energy.
In the United Kingdom, the Guardian newspaper has been showing what climate-responsible media can really be. If rising seas will swallow the East Coast, just as the climate-driven rains did this past week, maybe we need somewhere higher to go. Here is the Guardian newspaper's fake promo for the city that is safe from rising seas.
Denver, Colorado, a scenic metropolis on the doorstep of the Rocky Mountains. With a healthy economy and a growing population, Denver provides a great place for young people to start a future. Also, pot is totally legal. But what you may not know is when sea levels rise in 50 years due to climate change, Denver is also one of the highest cities in America and a prime candidate to be the capital of the world. Yes, many young people understand that their futures don't just depend on a city with a good economy and fun lifestyle. It also needs to not be completely underwater.
I mean, the Hunger Games totally nailed it.
Why live in a place that's going to be somewhere in the ocean in 50 years?
I'll have beachfront property eventually.
Why would I want to have a shark as a roommate?
I don't want our kids going to school with shark kids.
Also, pot's totally legal.
This is how I deal with climate change.
So what are you waiting for? Do what so many are already doing and move to Denver, the future capital of the world.
We'll close out the Guardian Climate Media with just a brief sample from New Orleans musicians Tom Henahan and David S. Lewis. They've had the climate change blues ever since Hurricane Katrina nearly drowned their city.
Now the world's getting hotter. California's in a drought. And not enough people know what they should do about if we lose our coastal cities. Will we keep on hitting snooze? Do Will we save our planet or get the climate change blues now? The climate change blues, baby. The climate change blues, honey. Everyone's gonna lose with the climate change blues. Tell me where we're stopping. Oh, what will we choose? Tell me, will we save our planet or get the climate change blues?
Find a link to the song Climate Change Blues at the Guardian newspaper or in my show blog at ecoshock.info. The whole series was sponsored by a progressive ice cream company. Now, I know music is a very personal thing. What I like, you may hate, and vice versa. That's why I leave my push for climate change music to the end of the show. Don't be afraid. I'm not going to try to sing. This week we have real musicians, the Cantrells. From Nashville, Tennessee, Al and Emily Cantrell perform Goodbye, Cool World. I'm Alex Smith. Thanks for listening to Radio EcoShock, and be sure and tune in next week.
I remember the breeze. It felt so nice. Felt like the wind blowing over the ice. No ice, but it was all gone in the blink of an eye. Goodbye, cool world, goodbye. Mm-mm-mm-mm-mm. I remember the sun before the drought. Back in the days when we used to go out. No doubt. Now we stay inside and hide from the sky. Goodbye, cool world, goodbye. Why, baby, didn't we open our eyes to the ghost of the future of human demise? Who would have thought back in 2013 we'd go extinct 'cause we wouldn't go green? I remember the earth, my home, sweet home. 200 degrees in Nome. No home could I biked, could I hiked. We just didn't try. Goodbye, cool world, goodbye. Demise. Who would have thought back in 2013 we'd go extinct 'cause we wouldn't go green? I remember the earth, my starter home. Now I'm in space living under a dome. No home could I biked, could I hiked. We just didn't try. Goodbye, cool world, goodbye. Could I bike? Could I hike? We just didn't try. Toast. My feet are saying, there's too much rain. Sayonara, somebody put out the fire. Goodbye, cool world, goodbye.